Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Anne Moreau, Director, Division on Technology and Trade Logistics, Head of the CSTD Secretariat, UNCTAD. Now, Anne, you have just an amazing and long success history and so many outstanding contributions that have global impact. And we're just so fortunate to have you come in today to do this interview and sharing so much of your experience and expertise and insights with the audience.
Well, first, thank you, Stephen, for your kind words. And I'm also delighted to share some of my views and, to some extent, the UN or UNCTAD views on very important issues with the audience.
Now, Anne, from your very early years up to the present, and this could be like maybe at the age of four and onwards, can you share a few notable events leading to your current role and then lessons you've learned for success?
Well, since you mentioned 4 years, initially I was not going to mention that, but I have been about, you know, 3 decades working for the UN. So talking about childhood, perhaps one of the events which led me to my present position is that there was a number of UNICEF campaigns because there were famines in Africa, and especially I remember Biafra, and that led me to, as a child, what could I do? So since we are talking about 4 years old, that's a very personal element. But more concretely, I mean, some of the events in which I participated in the UN, or at least which led to my work, there were a couple. I am now specializing in technology and trade logistics, but really technology and ICTs. But my career began in the UN with a work on transnational corporations, or perhaps more commonly called multinationals. And my first job was with the Center on Transnational Cooperation. And at the time, that center was very much linked to the, news and what was developing, because that center was created after the Allende event and the coup in Chile. And there were hearings in the UN on multinational, which led very concretely to this center. So, if you want, that very notable event was, in a way, very important in my career, because that was my first job. And my first job was actually to work, of course, as a junior professional, on a code of conduct on multinational corporations. Basically, what would be the obligations of multinationals operating, in particular, in developing countries, rights and obligation. And it's very interesting to see how that has evolved over the past 30 to 40 years. So that was my involvement is that work was quite decisive in terms of what I would do later on, because I continued focusing on multinational cooperation that led me to innovation, development, and technology. So I would say this is a kind of a pass line, if you want, that I followed. And the other event also, so which was quite important in my career. I don't know it's an event, but what was happening in the world led me to some mandate. I was asked by my organization to work on the debt crisis of developing countries. That was the mid-80s. And it was also very determinant, in a way, in the work that I would do later on.
You know, just a fascinating history, and it's interesting that even at an early age you had an interest in and sort of impacting the world in some fashion. Were you interested in economics and things like that as a very young child? Because I know you studied economics later.
Yes, I studied economy. No, not as a child, but actually we see much less of these campaigns, this UNICEF campaign, but in the 60s and 70s, there were very important campaigns in schools, including in schools in my home country in France, where basically the issues of poverty and hunger in the world was a key issue. interestingly, we still are talking about it, and we did that about 1 week ago in New York when the text of the SDG was agreed upon. We are still talking about poverty eradication. We don't really talk about hunger only, though it's a key point. There are also other elements which define underdevelopment. But to come back to this year of the 60-70 years, the UN at the time had a major campaign, at least in developed countries, and I believe that led to a generation of people like me who ended up working either for the UN or for NGOs or a very prominent organization which developed over the years.
Now, Anne, you're the Director of Technology and Trade Logistics Division in UNCTAD. What are your mandate and goals?
So basically, this is a relatively large division in UNCTAD. We have close to 100 people. The objective is to help developing countries in their development policies and in increasing their competitiveness. And doing that by working in, let's say, two, three main areas. The first areas is basically enhancing their science, technology, and innovation. In particular, increase access to ICTs. That's the word technology in the name of the division. The second one is to help developing countries be more competitive on international market by better logistics. Logistics meaning transport, custom services, for instance. And we have a third pillar, which is more broader, if you want, which is enhancing the capacity of policymakers in those areas through training programs. So that's the role of the division, and my job is basically to manage and lead that division.
Well, just an amazing opportunity in terms of the role that you play and how you can help countries continue to increase their capabilities and also take advantage of many of the global opportunities. Now, what are the key projects and wins, including for this year and into 2016? And what is the value to the stakeholders?
Okay. So basically, if you want, the key product, the division is part of UNCTAD. UNCTAD is the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. And if you want, the ultimate goal of UNCTAD is development. Actually, the logo of the organization is prosperity for all, meaning inclusive, development-oriented development approach. So in the division, we have three main lines of activity. The first one, research and analysis. And our objective is policy-oriented. Our research might end up with recommendation for policymakers, suggestion of what they could do, like in my area, to improve transport infrastructure or custom services in ports. The second avenue of activities is technical cooperation projects in the field, on the ground, helping developing countries improve again their services or their access to ICT, for instance. And the third avenue of activities is what we call, organizing intergovernment. We call it consensus building, but in a more simple formulation, it's organizing international meetings for countries to debate about specific issues, which, you know, later on, as time goes by, may end up into either international instruments or decisions or relating, for instance, to international trade. So that's the three type of activities that we are doing. So in 2015, in the first category, our key project is that we produced a report, which has two reports on ICT-related issues. The first one is a more a type of making the issue easier to understand and for policymakers to act upon, and it relates to the use of e-commerce for developing countries. It's called Unlocking the Potential of E-commerce for Development. How can developing countries take advantages of e-commerce opportunity to increase their exports, but also domestically? And this, in the ICT area, the other major research that we did, and I may come back later on, is we did a report on the information society and how it evolved over the past 10 years. In the technical assistance area, 2015, we had a major project. For instance, the WTO adopted in Bali. In 2013, the Bali Agreement, which is basically the Trade Facilitation Agreement, and our job is to help developing countries work to implement that agreement. It's relatively intricate. It has complex provisions. A number of developing countries needs to do to take a number of action to implement it, even before going to ratification. Our job is to help those countries go through these various steps. So we have helped about 99 countries already, and we still have further in the pipeline. Another key technical assistance project that we have, it's an ongoing one, is a major one. I was talking about trade logistics and customs. We have a very important program in developing countries, which is actually operating in 50 countries. We not only provide custom automated software for customs operation, if you want, but we train custom officials so that import and export in a particular country go more smoothly. That's a very, very important program. And again, 2015 was for us a key one because we developed a number of projects with a substantial, actually, impact in a number of countries, in particular in Africa. So these were really key activities. And I cannot, of course, ignore the work that we have done in the context of the preparation of the outcome document for the Sustainable Development Goals. It's very important, obviously, for the international community, and very concretely for us. There is, in this document, for the first time, a relatively long section devoted to technology, I mean, several parts at least of the document. And of course, we were involved as part of the UN system from the early beginning in preparing inputs or a background document for this declaration, which will be adopted at the General Assembly next September. This is a very important text because if you want to, it's a roadmap for the next 10 to 15 years in terms of development, what's to be done to eradicate poverty. We have done much more than that, but if you want in a few words, that were the main or the key activities of the years, and which we, of course, are going to continue up to at the end of 2015. And for 2016, the landmark, at least for the organization UNCTAD, will be its conference every 4 years. The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development as a big conference with all its member states, about 150 in this particular case. And we debate international key issues, and the program for the organization is approved by the member states. So for us, it's obviously a landmark activity for 2016.
You know, that's just an amazing series of projects. You know, you talked about e-commerce, the information society, the Bali Agreement, the work in implementation, this sort of 50 countries in the software on the custom side, training in the software in this area impacting Africa, the Sustainable Development Goals, SDG outcome documents, and the fact that there's long sections on technology and its impact, which will be adopted in September, and then a roadmap for the, which is the SDGs, that is, being the roadmap for the next 10 to 15 years. And then for 2016, you mentioned that every 4 years, there's this major conference of trade and development where all the key issues would be debated. So there's a lot on your plate. You know, one of the communities that I come from is the investment community. In fact, I chair some investment groups, but I'm also advisor and part of other investment groups. Is there some means that the investment groups can get involved in some way in terms of on the technology or on the science side in investing in developing countries?
Oh, yes, definitely. First, actually, in UNCTAD, I would like to mention that there is an investment division who deals specifically with investment-related issues, foreign investment, but also enterprise development. So it may be of interest to the group, to your group. Now, and how, what you are actually asking is that what can be the contribution of the groups that you are mentioning overall, if you want, non-governmental organization or civil society or even business in the work of UNCTAD. And what's very interesting is that as time has gone, I would say that the organization UNCTAD, but also the UN as a whole, has opened up to the other stakeholders. And in our particular case, we welcome the participation of non-government players, if you want, in our meetings, but also as far as investment is concerned, every 2 years we have the World Investment Forum, where its use of various kinds related to investment and enterprise development are discussed, where there are debate, workshops, and so on. So that is a kind of active participation, if you want, that can take place. My organization, UNCTAD, is working with policymakers. We do not do the investment, but we are a channel between, in some cases, the private players and the government, so that there is a better mutual understanding of the issues faced by both parties.
You know, that's fascinating. You know, I'm just going to ask a few more questions in this area because I see it's so key to the audience. You know, earlier this year, I chaired a session at the CIO Summit, and it was called CIO City. Now, CIO Summit, backed by CIOs, or called CIO City, and backed by something called CIO Net, represents about 5,000 CIOs, and the winners of the CIO of the Year were there, and in fact, I chaired the session with them. Some of the questions that come up from CIOs, these chief information officers of Fortune companies and government and from various sectors, you know, there's these developing nations. How can they encourage innovation from an entrepreneurship standpoint? And I see this also coming from the YPO, the Young Presidents Organization, which represents about 23,000 CEOs. And then there's the CEO organization as well. So let's say there's about 50,000 CEOs worldwide, and they're very much interested in innovation, plus these thousands of CIOs, chief information officers. Is there programs or can your group act as a bridge to help spawn entrepreneurship and startups through seed investments from these groups?
So how could I say, if I understand well, is that how could we facilitate investment, or if I understand, seed investment in developing countries? We are not a financial broker, if you want.
Right.
But our work is more to contribute to create a business-friendly environment, for instance, or to increase the understanding at the policy level, among policy level, of the issues faced by the private sector. And here I'm really talking about investment-related issues. So the kind of work that we do, for instance, specifically related, for instance, to innovation and technology, we have, in about 12 countries, we have undertaken reviews of their technology and innovation policies. So that we have done an assessment. What's the landscape? Do they have a technology and innovation policies? Do they have the appropriate educational system which answering the needs of the economy? What about the enterprise situation? So we do a review of all the elements of, if you want, the innovation ecosystem, mostly academia, research, education, private business, and government. And on the basis of the interaction and the assessment, we make recommendations on where are or where things could be improved. So that's the kind of activity that we do. And that's when we do that, we work together with the private sector, but I must say most of the time with the private sector of the beneficiary country of the developing country. In a number of occasions, it includes local enterprises and foreign enterprises. So that's how the relationship is established. However, I would like to say something which I find relatively striking is that there is a kind of awareness which has developed significantly among the developing world about the importance which should be paid to technology and innovation. It is something that you would not have seen 15 years ago. 15 years ago, that was in the academic textbook. You would take a course at Oxford or Paris or anywhere, or even Cairo or Dakar on enterprise and technology. You would have the academic approach. It has not yet entered, in my view, completely the policy circles. Now the position is very different. It's different at the national level because we have a number of developing countries which approach ANCTAD, for instance, for this review because they know they have to work on their enterprise sector, so they know that they have to help innovative enterprises to develop. But they also approach OECD, they also approach WIPO because there is a lot of intellectual property issue. So there is an awareness which has developed and which is increasingly developing at the national level. But it also very much reflected, as I said, in the international level, the outcome document of the SDGs, which I mentioned, Sustainable Development Goal, which is a very important document to be adopted at the General Assembly in December, but also a very recent meeting which is part of this overall attempt of the UN for SDGs. It's a meeting which took place in Addis on financing development. Both outcome documents pay lots of attention to technology. I have said the SDGs and the one I just mentioned, financing for development. There is a full chapter again on technology and innovation. And the word innovation is mentioned several times. If you compare that situation to the goals, the Millennium Development Goals, which were adopted 15 years ago in 2000, there is not that word. The word technology appears only once at the end of the MDGs in reference to the new technology. So if you want, the mindset has completely changed. It's reflected at the international level and at the national level. All countries are now very much aware of the need to work on technology and innovation. The United States, I mean, last year, for instance, there were a number of speeches. Mr. Obama speaks a lot about innovation policies. The European Union has a lot of innovation initiatives. China has major innovation plan, a number of Asian countries, but also African countries and Latin American countries. So it's, I would say the landscape has substantially changed if you compare to just, 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, I'm very struck by that. That really is the sort of the golden age of innovation, entrepreneurship, and impact of enterprises and how it's...
Yes, I mean...
Go ahead, sorry.
Definitely, the role of enterprise, or even interestingly, when I entered the UN, I was, as I said, working on multinational. And transnational corporation, multinational, had a very bad image. As I said, I entered the UN in 79, 3 years after the coup. We all know all what happened in Latin America and the perception of multinationals at the time. And then there were also a number of things along the years. So the perception of big enterprises was relatively negative. I don't say that it's completely positive, but at least the perception of enterprise, the entrepreneurship, the status and the aura is completely different. So that's quite interesting because it's also very much true for the developing world.
Yes, very key to capacity building. Now, you're also head
absolutely.
You're also head of the Secretariat of the United Nations Commission on Science and Technology for Development, CSTD. Now, what is your mandate and goals there?
So the CSTD is actually one of, it's called a functional commission of the United Nations. There is about a commission, one on forest, one on statistics, and one on technology. Very interesting. It was created in 1992, so it's a pretty old commission in UN standard. Basically, its role is to, if you want to provide the General Assembly and the Economic and Social Council of the UN with advice on important or at least relevant technology and innovation issues, so that eventually the General Assembly and the ECOSOC, they will be able, if you want to, with the member state within this fora, will develop common policies, common perhaps actions and measures that they will take together. So it's an advisory position or advisory function to the General Assembly and the ECOSOC, who the ultimate goal is to end up with a common policies and action on science and technology issues. So that's the role of the commission. It's a relatively, I mean, it's only 43 member countries, but it's very representative of the world because there is a 9 or 10 Latin American countries, 9 or 10 Africa, and so on. So each regional group is represented, and the commission meets every year. It has a specific program with a couple of themes to study and debate during 1 year, one week, and it debates on the basis of report prepared by the Secretariat of the CSTD, which I am heading, on various issues related to STI, and it can go for technology for water management and agriculture in developing countries, to renewable technologies, to digital development, for instance. So it's a very wide area of topic, but I must say quite fascinating.
Yeah, indeed. excuse me, especially during this time of so much rapid innovation that's occurring and really at a lightning speed today. So what are some of the key projects and wins, including for this year and into 2016? And again, what is the value to the stakeholders?
The value to the stakeholder, I mean, this commission is quite interesting because it really reflects the new epoch we are in. It's a commission which has increased in importance within the UN system, I would say, in the past five to six years. You know, I said it was created in 1992. It had a role, but I would say that, yeah, definitely since 2005 or so, its debate have, if you want, attracted increased attention from within the UN system. It has a number of themes which it studies every year. Just to give you an example, because I think it's also very much telling of perhaps where things are going. This year we had a first discussion on technology for sites. Basically, what could be the technology of the future? And of course, when the Commission examine this issue, it always examine it with a development perspective. What does that mean for developing countries? Because there is a major danger of marginalization for the poorest countries, those who really cannot really follow the race for technology or innovation. So what do these, all these changes that we are experiencing in various, you know, whether we are talking about environmental climate change issues to agricultural production, to ICTs, what are the changes and what will that mean for development in developing countries? So that was a key theme this year, and it will be also a very important theme next year, perhaps focusing a little bit more on ICTs. And so that was one major element of the work of the CSTD in 2015. The other key issue that the Commission looked at is relates to what in the perhaps the UN jargon, and I'll try to avoid using it, but still, is called the follow-up of the decision which were taken at the World Summit on Information Society. And there I will just perhaps inform or remind the audience that 10 years ago in 2005, there was basically the first biggest international conference on ICTs for development. It was called the World Summit on Information Society, and it took place in two phases, one in Geneva and one in Tunis. And the objective of this major conference was to examine a number of issues and also to have countries commit to a number of actions to encourage the development of ICTs in developing countries and also encourage the benefits to developing countries. The first paragraph of the declaration of the WISIS is basically that the member state commit to build an inclusive, development-oriented, and people-centered information society. And these are key words. So there are a number of actions which are included in this declaration. And going from, cultural issues to development of ICTs in rural areas, education, and so on. That was 10 years ago. And the international community at the time decided in 10 years from now, meaning 2015, we will take stock. What progress have we made? Where do we stand? What do we need to do perhaps for the next 10 years? And that's where we are now. So the CSTD was entrusted by the United Nations to follow up on the implementation of this World Summit Information Society to see basically where we stand. And the work of the CSTD has been to make its own assessment, and the Secretariat prepared a particular report on that, which I would encourage your audience to read.
Just
your
response is so rich. So what I'm hearing is that in terms of these key projects and wins for the CSTD is that especially in the last 10 years, it reflects a new approach and it's attracting attention. There's this technology of the future research that's happening,
yes,
what it means to the developing nations, and examples would be things like environment, climate, ICT, agriculture. These are important themes this year, but also next year with a focus on ICT. You also talk about WISIS and WISIS,
yes,
follow-up, and 2005 being the first WISIS instantiation in two phases from Geneva to Tunis, and a commit to action and encouraging the use of ICTs that are inclusive and people-centered for the information society. And then this year, taking stock, what has happened?
Exactly.
What should we do? And CSTD being a big part of that, and you're encouraging the audience to read the report.
Yes. So basically, the work of the CSTD and the Secretariat in that report was really to take stock, to see whether the targets which were in basically agreed upon in 2005, whether they had been reached, and if not, why, and what remained to be done. So it's a little difficult perhaps to summarize. It's a relatively large report, and actually the title of the report is called Implementing WISIS Outcome and Column, a 10-year review, meaning a 10-year review of the WISIS. So To summarize it, the visit at a number of, if you want, let's say main sections or portions, if you want. One of them was, there was a number of targets, which was, for instance, regarding access to ICT in internet in rural areas, access to ICT in internet in schools, and so on. So the assessment from that point of view is that there has been substantial improvement as far as ICT access is concerned in developing countries, thanks mostly, I would say, to the mobile revolution. So from that point of view, there has been major achievement. The perhaps lacking part now relates more to the content. There is an issue related to contents and ability to use the ICT. So that is the first point of assessment. With this outcome had another key chapter, which is related to internet governance. And this is a political part of the, if you want, the document. And on that one, there is major disagreement between countries. Some of them consider that the governance as was envisaged in the WCSCOUT outcome is not the one that we have nowadays, and there has been no progress, no sufficient progress, even no progress at all for some countries. And other countries consider that we are moving forward. Major progress has been made to enhance the governance of the internet architecture. So that's the situation. And on the second part, the assessments are so different between the different stakeholders that I would say there is no clear or decisive answers, partly because it's a highly political issue.
You know, it's interesting. You sort of mentioned the politics of governance. You know, I did interview, and in fact, I know Vint Cerf because I'm part
of it.
And I also interviewed Hamid Anturi, and I could see the two taking positions in the press and wherever. And in fact, I've interviewed both as well. So,
yes, indefinitely. And you have seen the various position. One group, but I will not go into the internet architecture, because you may have, you know, a 2 hour or 3 hour discussion. But the bottom line is yes. And this, I mean, I would not be presumptuous to talk after Vint Cerf on that, obviously. But the bottom line is that from the policymakers' point of view, some of them consider that the governance of the internet is not yet democratic, in spite of all the changes which have taken place, especially regarding the ICANN and the transition and so on. And there is a lot to be done. So that's one position. And the other group of people say, okay, over the 10 years, there has been substantial progress. The decision of the change of a stewardship from the United States regarding ICANN is a major step towards a change. And the governance of stakeholders of the internet is multi-stakeholder. There is an internet governance forum. So basically, we are in the right direction. And between the two, you have a spectrum of position. And definitely, you have given the name of two major personalities who have their own and not necessarily similar views on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You just mentioned ICANN, and many of the audience are probably not familiar with ICANN. Perhaps you can expound on ICANN.
Well, I will just say, well, I will very briefly, it's basically, ICANN is in the cooperation for assigned name and numbers. It's basically, it's the body which, very briefly speaking, deals with the assignment of domain names on the internet. So it's a key responsibility. And when it was created, there was a very strong relationship between the ICANN and the U.S. Department of Commerce for historical reasons. you know, because it was created, the internet was basically created in the U.S. So for historical reasons had happened, and because of that, there was a feeling among the other countries that it was not proper to have one country having such, you know, a strong relationship with an institution whose role is essential in the internet. So that was a big, major bone of contention in 2005, and the idea was to move ahead. So some countries consider that with the decision which have been taken place in 2014, where there will be a transition from the stewardship and the role of Department of Commerce to some independent form of ICANN, they consider this is a major step, plus all, many other steps which have been taken. And other countries consider there is still a lot to be done, and that we have not yet seen the actual implementation of the 2014 decision. So that's definitely a key issue, and we deal with that in our report. We put the two positions because, interestingly, this is more of how you see the situation from your own perspective as country X, Y, or Z.
You know, I read with interest this document that came out. I think it's from the ITU. I'm not sure if how much the CSTD had to do with it, but it was a matrix document sort of showing how the WSIS action lines align with the SDGs coming into the future.
Yeah.
It was long. It's somewhat repetitive, but I thought the information was very good in there. And will there be an attempt to kind of maybe streamline that document so it's a little bit easier to consume?
Most likely, I mean, the ITU is leading the exercise, and a number of international organizations which are responsible for actions to implement with this in education, that would be UNESCO, for instance, in business, that would be ANCTAD, on employment, that would be ILO. So many organizations are contributing to the work, what's called the matrix, which has been put out by ITU. Hopefully there will be attempt. I am not leading the exercise, but there are indeed suggestions to make the document cleaner. But at the end of the day, I think this document has two advantages or two roles. One role is very important. It was to show that you cannot implement the Sustainable Development Goal if you do not have ICTs. As basically is almost, it's infiltrating every part of the SDGs. And so that's basically, that was an objective, because it was, there is a feeling that the development of ICT is not sufficiently reflected in the document or the declaration which will be adopted in September. So the objective was to show that, for instance, in agriculture or you have a chapter on smart cities in the SDGs, obviously ICT are in there. You have specific goals for education. Everybody talk about now, you know, the huge potential of ICTs for education, ICTs and gender and so on. So I think the good of one of the good quality of this matrix was specifically to show where was the synergy between the goal and ICTs. Why that? Because concretely, what does it mean concretely? It means that for a particular country, which will have, for instance, which would say, okay, I devote particular importance to the goals on education, his education policy will also need to be an ICT policy. And it's very important if you want to contribute to developing that mindset, to have a broad approach. And basically meaning you can't have an education policy if you don't have an ICT policy. I mean, impactful. So that's basically, so there was the ITU has worked quite a lot on that. And I would agree with you that this matrix is very interesting, a little difficult to use right now, but its goal is also addressed to policymakers.
Yeah, in fact, it's sort of coincidental. Last week I was asked to write a foreword for a new book that's targeted towards college students. And and people who are, you know, pursuing higher education. And I talked about, and one of the questions or they wanted me to address in the introduction or forward was, you know, where's the future of ICT? And I actually mentioned the SDGs and WSIS and how ICT is really embedded everywhere. And that's why there's an opportunity.
It is. And it basically, some people see it as an enabler. Basically, for each of the goal, the one key enabler is ICT. There was the remark which was done was perhaps ICT should be a goal in itself. And then you end up with a kind of philosophical position. No, ICT is not a goal in itself. It's a means to achieve your goal. So that's why you have the SDG as you have. But I agree with you. I mean, they are almost embedded in 80% of the goals which are in the new declaration to be adopted next September.
Yeah, and for that reason, STEM education or education or enablement of our youth into ICT is such a valuable part of society today. No matter what you decide to do, any domain of science, any field of study should have some ICT education embedded in it. So.
Absolutely. So that's, for instance, that's the kind of message which also the international community has wanted to share globally. And from that point of view, I think it's achieving that goal. And I must say that the ITU with the matrix and the work they are doing is contributing to that, as well as actually as in our own area, the CSTD and other UN bodies.
You know, you talked about WSIS and you know, some of the sort of parts of WSIS and what, you know, what's the purpose of WSIS. I'm just going to open up that further. If there's any additional items that you want to bring forward about WSIS and the 10-year review of WSIS, that is the World Summit and the Information Society, because you're in charge of the work of the Secretariat related to this WSIS work. And then, are there any additional key projects and wins for this year or next year that you want to bring forward?
Yes, I mean, first I want to basically inform the audience, if they don't know that, I was saying that we are in the year of the review of this summit declaration, which, as I said, the declaration is very interesting because it was a major effort, about 5 years, perhaps not that much, but let's say around 4 years of negotiation and intense work by various stakeholders to end up with a text which quite fine, but I'll come back to that later. So, 2015, the year of the review, and the General Assembly will have a high-level event in December 2015, precisely to take stock of what has been achieved, and perhaps, but that needs to be seen, what should be done in the next 10 years or so. So that's a key date. The international, if you want, life for a community has had three major rendezvous, if you want, over the year. The first one is obviously the SDGs in New York. The second one is COP21 with climate change. And I would say the third one is a World Summit on Information Society big meeting, because they are dealing with key issues of for our planet. So for the CSTD, this indeed is an important date and important event, and that's why we prepared the report and we organized debate. That is the first one. But also in the context and perhaps more broadly speaking, I was mentioning a moment ago that the international community, as reflected or illustrated by what is happening in the UN, is devoted a lot of attention to technology in this 21st century. And interestingly, in Addis, at the Financing for Development Conference, and again, that is repeated in the SDG Declaration, there is for the first time, a creation of a technology facilitation mechanism. And the idea is to create, if you want, formally, a mechanism which will facilitate the access of developing countries to a number of technologies, and to encourage also the international community to debate about issues related to it. So I wanted to flag that idea because this is something which is a big change compared to 10 years or 15 years ago. And of course, the whole of the UN family is involved, and the CSDD definitely will be involved into the work in cooperation with other bodies which work very specifically with science, that would be the UNESCO, and perhaps industrial technology like the UNIDO. So that's a very interesting development. We will see how concretely it develop, but I believe it's a very important step, which I wanted to flag. And another step which has been decided, it is in the Sustainable Development Goal and in the Financing for Development Declaration, is the creation and the actual beginning or work of what's called a technology bank, which is, the World Bank is a little misleading, but it's an institution which will facilitate the development and access to technology of the poorest countries in the world, the least developed country. That also is a key landmark in this year, and I really wanted to flag that.
You know, one of the things that struck me, and I was invited to speak on July 2nd. In fact, you chaired the opening session on July 2nd, so it was fascinating. That's where I got an opportunity to meet you and see your genius at work. It's just amazing. But one of the things in terms of WISIS and the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, is that perhaps they didn't fully anticipate the impact of smartphones and mobile technology and broadband. Oh, yeah. So then now the question is, what is impending on the future? And is there, I sense now there's a bit of a different stance and saying, you know, we don't want to be caught left behind. We want to know what's happening in the future and being able to properly anticipate that, and this could be things like precision genetic medicine and something called CRISPR-Cas9, which is really cheap to alter genetic sequences and even in human beings, or you know, machine learning and deep learning and the impact on robots and so on. Major revolutions and innovations that are actually happening on a daily basis. They're happening so quickly. Fundamental disruptive waves and pivots that are happening daily. How do we anticipate that? How do we plan for that? And then how does that influence the SDGs and WISIS going into the future?
It's very interesting because you have put your fingers or your finger on one of the challenge actually of we say plus 10 review and going forward is also one of the key if you want conclusions of our report. It's basically when you look at the WISIS outcome documents, the one adopted in Geneva and the Tunis Agenda, adopted only 10 years ago, the word mobile, there is no mention of mobile. This is very interesting. Not to even mention social networks. Not even mentioning cloud computing. And, you know, it's a very short period of time. It's 10 years. And the people who worked on that at the time, you know, they were policymakers. So perhaps you may say, okay, there's a level of anticipation when you are not an IT specialist. But you also had people who were working in the field. So the thing what perhaps was emerging, but the use which would be made of it was not anticipated. So at WISIS in 2005, there are targets and actions which are taken, which correspond to the world of 2005, but not the one of 2015, or not even the one of 2010. There is not much mention of privacy, or there are mention, yes, or implicit mention of freedom of expression, but The accent is not really very, well, it is dealt with, but it's not very, very strong, perhaps as one would like to have nowadays. So the key challenge nowadays is if you want to have a declaration or a document which is very exhaustive and try to anticipate every, you are bound to be anyway obsolete in 3 or 4 years from now. So that's really a challenge, you know. How do you take a plan of action? How do you encourage or how do you fix goals while not really knowing how the future will look in 5 years from now? And that, I think, was a feeling which was perceived by most policymakers. And then one way is to say, okay, we have a declaration, we don't touch it, we just amend it a little bit. And another way is to say, okay, we are bold and we try to have, to plan or to anticipate. And that's basically the major challenge. And perhaps the approach is to have a formulation or action which are flexible targets, which are short-term targets, so that you can take stock of every two or three years to know where we are, whether you need to revisit or to redirect and so on. But it's basically due just simply to the nature of the ICT sector, is that planning, even a five-year plan, is, I would not say impossible, but very, very hard to do. And it's very striking when, you know, when you read the declaration with the minds of 2015 and you say, we miss that, or we miss that point. And that's something which now I think negotiators and policymakers are, in a way, you want to leave enough flexibilities internationally, but also even nationally, so that you don't basically inhibit innovation, or you want actually to foster innovation. So you are basically taken between two parameters which are not easy to conciliate.
Yeah, and I guess because I belong to different scientific groups, you know, like for example, I chair with the ACM this group that tries to anticipate products and services for the computing community, not just today but also into the future. You know, there are these impending changes that are probably the biggest social, cultural, economic changes that have ever occurred in our society, and they're going to happen in the next few years. And I guess it's really going to be impossible to predict the outcomes and the unintended outcomes
exactly
coming forward. And so, you know, it's a great time of excitement, but also maybe of risk as well.
And because, you know, when you listen to Vint Cerf or other fathers of the Internet, you see that basically it was almost, I mean, actions were taken, discovery, inventions, innovation took place, but at the time they took place, even those who were at the heart and at the origin of this technology did not necessarily anticipate the use which would be done and how it would all evolve. So That's a challenge, I think, facing everybody. It's true in any scientific area, but I would say even more so in the ICT field, where the pace of change is tremendous.
You know, there's something within WSIS and the SDGs for consideration. I mean, I can see that there's this recognition of the local culture, traditions, and practices. And an example could be something like in China, you know, where meditation practices, or in Tibet, meditation practices. There's even some research to indicate that meditation can be beneficial from a health standpoint or a well-being, mental mm-hmm. health standpoint, or acupuncture and the broader aspect of traditional Chinese medicine. Do you have any views on that, sort of this idea of the local culture, the local traditions and practices? And I can see them now being embedded into the planning and a respect for those practices.
Yes, actually, I mean, what is interesting as far as this is concerned is in the WSIS documents, you know, the Geneva one, there is a whole section on cultural diversity and identity and local culture, and that's quite interesting to see. That was already in 2005, there is also particular attention paid to the way the new technology could help promote cultural diversity, you know, not necessarily globalization and uniformization, the same for all, but on the contrary, it could be an interesting tool to preserve and promote local culture. And I must say that that's why I say when you read this declaration, 2003 or 2005, you see that it's a very interesting text because at least some parts are still extremely valid. That's what we say. There are a number of principles which are still valid today, and definitely the one on cultural diversity, identity, and so on, and local culture is very much so. And there is actually, interestingly, in the WISIS document, in the declaration, what is called an action line on cultural diversity and local culture, and specifically the UNESCO, which is responsible for action in that area. So, bottom line, it meant that at the time, the negotiators were very much aware of the potential and also of the threats. So that, I think, is very encouraging. In the SDG, there is a reference, but it's only in a couple of places, but I agree with you. I think that there is at least a very, it's only one paragraph, which refer to traditional knowledge, and that's very important because it's definitely reaffirmation of the role of traditional knowledge. And the paragraph specifically states that the countries agree to ensure access to and fair and equitable sharing of benefits arising from the utilization of traditional knowledge. And of course, this has a very powerful, basically, meaning, including for the questions related to how traditional knowledge can be appropriated. Of course, this is a whole Pandora box. Because you have all the intellectual property issues which are related to that. But it is true, I mean, you are rightly pointing out the fact that the SDGs pay attention to it. Some people would say that it could have done a little more, but given the size of the text, I think it's not too bad, actually. There is also reference on other places to the need to respect cultural diversity and to recognize that all culture and civilization can contribute to sustainable development. I think that these are perhaps sentences like that, but they reflect and they are very important. It's very important to state them in a document like the SDGs. So from that point of view, I think it's a positive.
Now, you're in this really interesting position in that you work on and, you know, you're leading some of the reports on technology innovation in this role with regards to UNCTAD and so on. Do you have any sort of metrics or stats or trends that you can share from your role?
Well, there are a couple indeed, related to technology and innovation and ICTs. And perhaps what I find particularly, there would be many if you want, but if I were perhaps to concentrate only on a few, one of them would be somehow a shift or at least a rebalance of innovative and R&D capabilities in the world, basically from north to south, or de facto from north to largely Asia and a little bit Latin America. And I just wanted to flag, you know, some interesting things, because these were data that we also mentioned in a report that we are going to publish at the end of the year. This is a report on innovation policies in developing countries. It's a report which highlights the increasing awareness of policymakers, but at the same time, the difficulties that they have to set up innovation policies, to design them, and to concretely implement them. And where are all the traps? So in that report, for instance, we highlight definitely the change which has been taking place. And just to, you know, to just a figure. In 2012, and which is more basically the past 2 to 3 years, the ratio of R&D expenditure to GDP, which gives an idea of research and innovation intensity. It's not perfect in that discuss, but that's the one we have. For the developed country, it's that ratio was basically R&D expenditure. It was about 2.3% of GDP for the developed countries. And countries, for instance, developing country, you are getting close to 1.5-2%, which is a substantial increase compared to 10 years ago. But what is more interesting, if you take country like China, what's called the research intensity of China is now almost close to 2%, and it was 1% at the beginning of in the early 2000, for instance. If you take a number of countries in Asia, like Hong Kong, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore together, their research intensity is higher than the developed work. It's 2.4%. What does it mean? It means that you have had a significant catch-up from that part of the world compared to the developed country. It's very, very interesting. In Korea, the ratio of research expenditure to GDP is more than 4%. So I think it's quite telling. And last year, I think it is the OECD who put out an interesting report about research and development and innovation. And it showed that in 2002, China had overtaken Europe in terms of research intensity. Their expenses in percentage of GDP was higher than the average of the EU. And the OECD predicts, I don't know whether that will take place, that China will also overtake the US by the end of this decade. So again, China is just an illustration, and it's a particular case also. You cannot generalize, but Brazil is an interesting case. South Africa is not doing very well, but it's trying, and a number of Asian countries are really and have already actually caught up. So I think that's kind of thing we have looked at in our report, and we will develop. And conclusions that we have in our discussion is that you still have a couple of laggards in Latin America and, of course, in Africa, and we have a number of recommendations on what should be done in terms of not research and development expenditure, but perhaps wise innovation policies. Not necessarily putting more money, but using it more efficiently and perhaps in a better coordinated way. That's the first metrics, if you want, or trends that I'd like to share, because I think it's very reflective also of, you know, these are data which explain international trade, international production system, and the changes that we are experiencing nowadays in the world, and what is happening in developed economy, in developing economy, and also challenges in developed economies. How are you going to deal with that? I mean, I think for me it's quite a telling trend. And the other one is all the trends relating to ICTs, which on which we are working substantially, and which also show the huge power and the transformative power of ICTs, and what I call, you know, the mobile revolution. Just one figure is there are now as many mobile subscription of the world as there are people. Of course, you still have unequal distribution of this subscription, but still it's quite interesting. And in developing country, you know, the percentage of you have about 60 or 70 subscription of mobile for 100 inhabitants. 10 years ago, you had about 20. So there is a major difference. So that's the kind of metrics also I like to keep an eye on, because this technology has a substantial transformative power, and as it is expanding, if it can be properly leveraged, it can be a powerful development tool. That is the first point. The other statistics that I like is that basically internet users, you know, the next billion internet users will mostly come from developing countries. That is also very important, because economically it has implication, but also politically. You cannot manage the internet and govern the internet with a situation like that, which is so different of what it was 10 years ago.
You know, it's amazing times, and, you know, there's some research to say that social learning is what distinguishes how we evolved, and certain communities, even within human society, have from a technological standpoint or a scientific standpoint, have progressed faster than others. Social learning meaning you have a community which has a critical mass who speak the same language, and you can share and copy and innovate as a result, because you have this critical mass.
Because you have communication, basically. I mean, this communication, I mean, this is a key, and it's opening up so many opportunities in developing countries. There is a problem for the least developed, the poorest of the poorest. There is still a substantial problem. But an important part of the developing world is benefiting from this new technology.
Yeah, and especially the internet, because it widely allows people to engage, and you can see why all these different corporations are, you know, producing drones or high altitude balloons, or, you know, this proposal of low altitude, hundreds of them, perhaps thousands of satellites to provide universal coverage.
Yeah.
And then it kind of, you know, ties into this idea of social learning. You know, perhaps that's what allowed humans, modern day humans, to surpass Denisovans or Neanderthals, perhaps, right? It's because of the social learning aspect. Or, you know, that China right now has surpassed the U.S. and patents that up in last year, I guess. And,
yes, exactly. I mean, that's...
Actually,
something which I did not say, but also something which dragged me, is that last year, the Chinese expenditure on research and development were the second in the world. I mean, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, and there's such a large critical mass of people who have a similar education system, though there's many diverse languages within China or dialects, but there's still one universal language that people are asked to know. So again, there's this aspect of social learning, large community, critical mass, sharing of information, and there's pockets within China from an educational standard level now are ranking in the top two or three in the world, right? So, and in the West, we're complacent. We're thinking, gee, we're number one or two. And if you look at the stats on some of the education rankings, maybe we're 20th or 15th, you know, and, you know, some countries in Europe and also in Asia are in the top 10, right? So it's interesting that the world is becoming a lot flatter in that sense, and a lot more equal.
From that point of view, yes.
So, you know, and, you know, you're at the crux, or you're the center of an ecosystem. You're the hub of an amazing ecosystem in many respects, and especially with the fantastic history that you have. And as a result, you're aware of so much, or have your threads, in essence, throughout the world, where you're getting input from so many different areas. So what do you see as some of the key issues with the ICT sector, and particularly computing, and what are your recommendations?
I mean, there are a number of issues, you know, with a sector, but perhaps there are a few fundamental issues, I would say, or question to some extent. The first one is, you know, the role of the ICT as potentially a sector which will lead to increased equalization, you know, among people and country, or on the contrary, increased inequalities. So because there is a danger of marginalization for those who are not in the bandwagon. So I think this is a key issue in terms of what can happen to one part of the world. Another key issue, there are many, but that's basically I would just flag somehow too. The second one is, I would say, is related to the ICT sector. It's an impact on the society, for instance, through employment. And the question is that, will ICT positively contribute to fight unemployment, or will it lead to, you know, a labor market which is two-tier, or will it lead, as some people are, you know, kind of predicting, a substantial readjustment problem? And that's a question, I think, for policymaker to look at substantially. If you are in a knowledge economy, the impact is not necessarily negative, but that implies that you have a proper education policy. And then what kind of countries are we talking about? If, on the contrary, you have in an economy which is not really a knowledge economy, but much more an economy where the labor factor is actually your competitive advantage, comparative, you may be in trouble. What are you going to do with these people? How do you train them? I mean, it opens up a number of questions, and it raises a substantial issue for policymakers. That's definitely an area for study and examination, the impact of ICTs on labor markets. And that's a key issue. And perhaps the last one, which in my view is essential to the ICT sector, is all the relationship between ICT and how it influences our own personal life in terms of privacy, confidentiality, and also freedom of expression. And again, that calls for good policies and always being on the watch. And that means that you have policymakers, but also other stakeholders which are equipped to deal with the issues. So I think these, for me, are some of three essential issues related with the ICT sector. I'm sure there are many others, perhaps more of a technical nature, but that's the one I would say I'm confronted more in my work.
You know, Anne, from your work, it's clear from all the reports that you've done and also all the sort of discussions and areas that you've led and also embedded within the SDGs and with this action lines is that ICT is fundamental to everything and in many respects and will continue to be so. In fact, its importance will, in my opinion, continue to grow. So underlying this idea of professionalism. And when I mean by professionalism, I mean ethical conduct, demonstrated professional development, personal responsibility, public accountability for ICT professionals and those who use ICT, because there could be a lot of breaches or, misconduct. And especially when ICT is embedded in so many areas. So what are your views about this idea of professionalism, this idea of personal responsibility, public accountability, continuing professional development, ethical conduct, and so on? And do you have any recommendations with regards to professionalism and also to ethics?
Well, as far as professionalism, if you talk about professional development and the certification of people working in the field or accreditation, I think I would be quite favorable to it. Though I must say at the same time, wanting to regulate too much sometimes is that you have the odd spaces which will bring you the unexpected. And that's how also science, you know, develop. And especially in the ICT field. A professional activity with some level of recognition and accreditation, but let's also leave a little bit of flexibility for those who do not fit that mood. Now, if you go into the area of accountability or personal responsibility, I mean, that have mixed feelings in a way, because accountable for what, you know? If you are putting out a software or if you are doing a particular activity related to ICT. I mean, there are professions where, you know, you are supposed to deliver, then there are a number of regulated professions. We have that in France, for instance, and this is very much the national context depends a lot. But calling for an accountability clause, if you want, or an accountability of the profession bothers me a little bit. Because where will it begin? Where will it stop? You may, for instance, when you do a discovery or when you make, a step in a scientific field, your invention or even what can be used one way or another. It can have positive or negative effects. Of course, this is a caricature, but still that's the situation. And should you be responsible for the way what you are putting out is not properly used? That's why I feel uncomfortable. And this is very different from somebody who uses a particular software to enter into your data or sabotage or steal data. That's definitely, there are rules and legal law is developing for that. It's a whole new area. But the accountability of the profession, I think I have mixed feelings. It can be an inhibitor of progress. Sometimes by aiming at the best, at the end, you do not reach your objective and it can even backfire. So I have mixed feeling about it, you know. There are a number of discovery and, you know, the first example people will give you is a nuclear one. There are very positive and negative views. So, of course, it's a completely different situation, but still, you know, there are views, you know, that social media are available. Who is responsible? Is the vehicle responsible? Is those putting? Is those who have set up a particular software? Where is the line of responsibility and accountability? It's a very intricate thing. So, if you talk to me about the computing profession, I'm not sure I would go into a very much regulated profession from the accountability point of view. I think it's a little bit dangerous.
So what I'm hearing, I
may not be in the politically, and I would say in the major line, but I'm looking at it also perhaps from my European context. It may well be that in the U.S. context is very different, but this issue of accountability can backfire.
So what I'm hearing though, Anne, is that from an ethical conduct standpoint, I don't think anybody has issues, right?
Absolutely.
Adhering to a code of ethics.
You do your best. I mean, you do your best. You put out a right. document or you put out a software. There is a code. Yes, that is different in a way. But make somebody accountable. Accountable has a very strong meaning. I mean, at the end of the day, you'll have to pay for something for which you may not be responsible. So.
Yeah, so professionalism, I think, is a spectrum, and part of that spectrum is ethical conduct and adhering to code of conduct. The other thing is, or ethical conduct, the other thing is adhering to professional development on a continuing basis so that you're current and you don't have old knowledge.
Exactly. No, that's something different, actually. But at the end of the day, the market will, most likely, you know, if you are not following up the development, after a while, you are you're not in demand any longer, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. So those are actually part of the spectrum of what we define as professionalism. The other thing is quality assurance. There's some assurance that you're adhering to some quality standards. So, you know, you're not just sort of putting up credentials as you're an expert when you maybe have very little training or education in the area. Or some combination of the two. So professional development or quality assurance. I think those are areas that are are not problematic from a professionalism standpoint.
No. And if you have the necessary accreditation certificate, if you have gone to the university, for instance, it can be open university, it can be formal university. At the end of the day, if you receive a recognized diploma, that's maybe, of course, an issue. Then, yes, you have that accreditation which will ensure the people who are using your services.
Yeah, and I guess
you also have to do some due diligence before you give your, before you give the job to somebody.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I guess the only sort of areas of controversy is probably more not so much maybe not the personal responsibility in the sense that, but maybe the public accountability and what I'm hearing from you though is that has to be carefully thought out if it's enacted. Carefully, the scope has to be carefully defined so that it doesn't have these implications where you make a discovery and on 20 years later for some reason you...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because you will inhibit innovation. People will not dare because by precaution they would say, no, I'm not going to do that or I'm not going to do that or I'm careful. I think if you put limit to some extent to the imagination, and that's what you may end up doing, it's, you know, after all, we are talking about science, technology and innovation.
Yeah. So I think there's ways to do that. And that is by, you know, taking the lead from medicine or law or accounting, which are regulated professions, or engineering, where you carefully define the limits of that scope of accountability so that it doesn't limit innovation. So I believe there's ways to address it. And you bring up a very valuable point. It can't be unrestricted accountability or you know, it'll limit innovation. So, you know, we really have explored this area of professionalism and ethical conduct and so on, and perhaps even, you know, some policies that could be related to this area. Do you see other areas related to computing that you need to be brought into focus for discussion and policy?
Well, no, right now, really, the one I think are essential to me are the one related to privacy and security. I think they are they will determine the future of perhaps the usage of IT in ICTs. I would not.
Okay, now...
There may be others, but they would not come to my mind right now after our discussion.
Right. And it's great that, you know, we're entering this discourse and the interview's public, so you're bringing up really great points that people have to consider, and especially somebody of your stature and in your experience, and, you know, we definitely have to pay attention to all the insights you're bringing in this discussion here. Now, we're going to switch directions, and we're going to sort of mine your career or your personal experiences. You must have come across something that you considered impossible, and then due to due diligence or just perseverance or whatever, you were able to master. Are there any stories you can share that are like that?
Impossible, at least definitely very tough challenges, perhaps not necessarily impossible challenges, but a tough challenge, definitely. Because in any case, I would say that, you know, somehow impossibility very often is in your mind. I mean, that has been actually my experience. If you believe in it, at the end of the day, you manage, I would say. Now, one of the very difficult challenges and tough challenges, a very recent one, is the one that we had to do with this 10-year review. It was only a few months. It was a monumental work, and it was highly political and very difficult to do. And the important thing was to be as objective as possible, to listen to everybody, and not to leave out your own appreciation. And that's basically when you work in an international organization, in a way, to the extent possible, and especially doing that kind of work, you have to leave at the door whatever of your a priori feelings, which are, if you want, assessments, which may be linked to a number of parameters related to your education and so on. And you have to approach the problem with a complete, to the extent possible, a very, very open mind. And when we did this report, we really had to approach it with an open mind and also understand the other parties or all of the parties' position on issues which are very, very different for cultural reasons, political reasons, political settings, or just societal issues. And that's I've really experienced that when we did this report, because when we looked at the document, we did a survey to ask all stakeholders, government, civil society, academia, business, basically how they found the how they assessed what had happened in the past 10 years, where were the issues, where the challenges, and so on. And sometimes we had answers which we were a group of people, you know, a diverse group of people being the UN, and sometimes we were, I would not say surprised by the question, by the answer, but we did not necessarily see what was the other problem. And it was very interesting to read and try and to put yourself in the other person's foot. So that was a very tough job because the task was very, very large. And I would not say it was impossible, but it was definitely quite tough. And it was very interesting to listen to the other with a complete open mind. I mean, it was kind of, I enjoyed that actually very, very much. So that was the kind of, I would say, the toughest, perhaps most recent challenges. I have had a couple of them over the year, more related to the fact that you had to deliver, being with the UN, and also nowadays, I think, the role with relatively limited resources in a relatively limited of time, an output. That has been a tough challenge, but eventually, I managed, I would say.
You know, my follow-up question is sort of what important lessons can you summarize? But I think you've done some of that, right? Be inclusive, be open-minded, be flexible in your thinking, persevere through that process. Are there any others?
Well, actually, I must say, working on ICT and especially in the context of WISIS, you know, in the World Summit on Information Society, and basically because of the structure of Internet, where you have at the root of the Internet, you have, for instance, the people who are in charge of the technical, the engineering parts, which are individual, groups of individuals. There is a lot of the way the architecture of the Internet is very interesting, and it explains why there is so much attention paid to this multi-stakeholder approach and listen to everybody. And I draw a lesson from these various years of working on Internet-related issues, participating in meeting with NGOs, whether within the UN context, whether in national surrounding, whether in ICANN, where you listen to people. And initially, it might be cumbersome to try to listen to all those who are participating, to have this multi-stakeholder approach. But at the end of the day, it's quite enriching. And nowadays, you have to do it. If you don't do it, you miss out. And basically, that's definitely one of the lessons I had to learn, to be open, to listen, and to really do these extra efforts to bring into the game those who wanted to say something and who had something to say. So that definitely was a lesson which I drew from this most recent year. At the same time, it opened up the issue of, you know, what is the stakeholders, and when you operate in that kind of environment where everybody has a voice, who represent one is eventually a question which is beginning to arise. So that is also a lesson which I think I draw out of it, is that in the forthcoming, in the future years, when we do exercises where we want to involve all the communities which have a say and which are interested in a particular issue, you have to do it in a very intelligent way, so that you give the floor in a way to those who represent and who have something to say. But at the same time, it's extremely enriching, and I think you get a lot out of it, actually.
Well, Anne, it's interesting. When I talk to some of your colleagues, and you have this amazing reputation as somebody who is very agile and inclusive and expansive in your thinking. So, and this comes across in this interview as well. Now, you're in this current role, and you're leading many initiatives and responsible for different kinds of reports and so on. There's so much what I call noise out there. That is, you don't know what's good information, what's bad information. Are there any top resources and lessons that you can share with the audience?
In terms of basically to share with the audience on what do you mean ICT related issue, or to understand a little better, or
Yeah,
because I think
so.
your audience is already quite sophisticated in the area.
Yeah, so for example, people ask me sometimes what kind of resources do I recommend? These are people who work in computing. I'll say, well, the ACM has their digital library. I'll mention different societies where it's highly curated, it's very trustworthy. I may mention a particular media outlet, let's say TechCrunch or IDG IT World, which I trust from a value standpoint. In terms of all the available resources out there, are there any ones that you would sort of pinpoint and say, you know what, this is a good resource? You've actually mentioned some of them already, some reports and so on, but are there others that you can mention?
Well, definitely the report, if you know, sometimes people working in a particular trade or industry, they look at it from their standpoint, okay, which can be very technical, or from their own markets. And the approach, I mean, the value in a way of our work is that it gives perhaps a broader approach. It gives a development perspective, and it raises issue from a development point of view for people in the industry which would have looked at the issues differently. So, for instance, I would just mention two or three reports I think that is doing, and perhaps one which I came across very recently from. In addition to the one that I mentioned, which is on the WSIS outcome, if people read at it, and people from the industry, for instance, or from the technical part, they may look at what they are doing, and they may look at the implication of what they are doing with a different or a more political eye. And I think that's what's interesting. That's why I say that the WSIS, implementing the WSIS outcome report was interesting. But we do also report which are reports for policymakers. So they are not IT techniques. It's more for politicians and no, for policymakers actually, people in the government, what all these IT related issues, what does it mean for them? And we published, for instance, I just gave the title of two that we had very recently. One of them actually was on it was in 2013, I believe. It was on information technology and the development of the small private enterprises in developing countries. And that was quite interesting because there has always been this idea, especially in developing countries, that this is too complicated, it's too expensive, it's not for us. So the report, in relatively, simple presentation, deals with the pros and cons, the opportunity, and what to watch out as an SME in a developing country. But the highlight is more on the benefit of this new technology for your business. We had another report that we did actually last year, which is the issue of cloud computing. Many people consider this issue as an issue for developed countries, but also for developing countries, what does it mean? Can your company ignore it? And you, as a government, what does it mean for you? You know, there is all this question about the server, the national server, and the cost, and so on. So that is a kind of, you know, it's not an introduction, but it's looking at a technical issue from a completely different point of view. And the last one we did was on e-commerce and developing country. We looked a lot at the legal issues there. And that one is interesting in terms of having a snapshot of whether there are legislation in countries to deal with e-commerce legislation. And that's quite interesting because the conclusion is that there are progress, but there is still a lot to do. So that's a kind of, for instance, report from my own organization that I would highlight. So they are from UNCTAD. They can be found in the UNCTAD website on the page related to technology and innovation. And then another report which I found very easy to read and which raises a couple of interesting also questions for the future with a particular mindset is the latest, for instance, ISOC report 2014, which I think was also putting the finger on a few policy-oriented question related to internet development, which, you know, is easy to read and quite pleasant.
You know, thank you for providing those resources. I know the audience would find them of great value. You've already discussed some trends and metrics and so on from your various roles. Do you have any additional predictions for the future that you want to share? And I know it's a delicate area, right? Because how can you predict today? It's going to be very difficult. And then the second part to that question is there anything that ICT executives in the audience can do to act on your predictions?
Well, prediction, as you know, I'm always aware of predictions, but even more in the ICT areas. And in any case, you know, one of the it's not really a prediction, it's more a consequence of what is happening. I would say my first thing is that it's the demographics are back. I'm very much struck by the demographic parameter in today's economies, I would say. You know, it's very interesting. I mean, I think it's only last year, I believe, that we were told that we had reached 7 billion people on the planet. And just during my lifetime, between the time I was born till nowadays, we have gone from, I think, something like 4 billion to 7 billion people. So for me, that is quite staggering. And the past 20 years, we have added 1 billion people every 12 to 13 years. I mean, so I know the growth. Demographic growth is going to somehow the rate of growth is going to decline, but we have reached a huge population which actually will lead to a number of issues relating to access to resources, but that's another point. But bottom line, the implication for that are the need for this publication and the population, and especially as it relates to migratory movements. I'm thinking in particular migration from rural to urban and all the needs of this new urban population. And around that, there is a huge role for ICTs and ICT use in terms of urban infrastructure. So that's, I think, you know, that's, and there is, it's very interesting, I would say in the past 5 years or so, there has been an increasing amount of conferences, meetings dealing with how to do with urbanization, how to deal with the problem, and more specifically, how to use a new technology to cope with the new urban challenges, from garbage to basically transport to water and so on. So that's, I think, is my prediction is really around the needs for this urban population. The other one is obviously, you know, as I said, my prediction is a shift of I don't know whether you can call it power, but definitely redistribution of the cards as a result of the fact that, as I mentioned a moment ago, the next 1 billion users from the Internet will be from developing countries. So you have a redistribution of the cards. That's definitely one can predict. And at the same time, these people will have specific needs, which are not the needs of affluent societies. And how do you respond to these needs? I mean, there will be there definitely opportunities. It does not mean that there will always be a market, because there is a difference between having 1 million people in need and 1 million people able to pay to get this need taken care of. But still, I think there is quite a mass of opportunities as well, actually, needs which will be required to be served, whether by the public sector or by the private sector. And perhaps my third point, which I have already mentioned, but my prediction is that I'm very much, you know, how do you say, spending, or my mind is very much on privacy, security issues, because it will affect the way the internet is used, because a lot is based on trust and credibility. And this is, if that cannot be ensured, the way we will look at internet and the way and what it can bring us will be completely different. It may even affect our relation and our communication. So I think that is this is a crux for the forthcoming years as far as internet development is concerned. How can you ensure individual? Is it even possible that as individual they will be respected? Because the tools are there and they are already there. So that, I think, and it's very worrying to some extent to an increasing percentage of the population. Not that much, but it's beginning to come. So that is my third. I would not call a prediction itself, because it's already there, but the implications of for the internet usage, in my view, will be quite determining.
You know, Anne, we're...
And there is no...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Talking about privacy and security, I just wanted to say that UNESCO is working a lot on that. But as of now, I don't know if there is any tool. And there is the lack of trust which may develop is something that the private sector and governments have to watch out.
Now, we're down to our last remaining questions. And maybe what I'll do is I'll let you use... And I'll use the term cherry pick. You can sort of choose the one you want to answer, because I know that you've got to go pretty soon. So I'm going to ask a series of questions, and then you can say, yeah, I think I want to answer that one in the remaining minutes. So, you know, you've been a very successful leader, and perhaps there's some leadership lessons you want to share, or you may want to share something about some of your outside interests and or maybe some story that you've come across in your extensive speaking travels and work, or any other topic here or broader issue. So sort of the canvas is open for you to paint openly.
In terms of stories, there is one or two that I would like to share. First, I would say that working for the UN is very gratifying, actually, at the end of the day. You know, I have many, many years, and I will not stay very, very long, perhaps, in the UN. I could soon reach retirement. But I think in terms of my experiences, I always been very comforted by the fact that when you bring to people access to knowledge, and when you give them the tool, it's the eye opener it's in your eyes, and that I have experienced it in my training activities, especially in my early years of career, has been very fascinating and very enriching. And I would encourage young people, you know, to also have approached issues with that state of mind. That's the first one. And the second one is that it's very recent. Sometimes you read through reports. You may or may not know that in 2014 was the year of the small island states. And the seeds, as we call them in the UN jargon. And in September, there was a major international conference for small island states. It's a conference which takes place every 10 years. And the idea is basically to assess the challenges, to see what has been done, and perhaps to develop assistance program or to help countries in a number of areas. And the case of those countries are obviously their biggest problem is climate change. I did not realize, for instance, that some of these states are, we know that they are going to disappear, but when you go, I went to Samoa, which is where the island where the conference took place. It's in the Pacific, a little in the middle of the Pacific, so, I mean, relatively close to Australia, but it's still 6 hours of flight. And that's where I realized how basically distance and geographical distance is a major impediment. You really live through it. Samoa is an island with an harbour, which can accommodate 4 or 5 very, very big boats. It's among the small island state of the Pacific, not a very, very small one. And I was talking with people who are taking, I was a harbour, and I was talking to people who were living in small island, which is an independent one, which is called Tokelau. And, you know, they were telling me it's a 1 day of boat, and there is no airport, and not even heliport is difficult. Going by helicopter is almost impossible. So I realized how these people were completely isolated from that point of view, from the rest of the world. And that's definitely an area where this new technology makes a world of difference. But they are confronted substantially with the fact, for instance, with the cost of cable submarines, which is, you know, huge cost. So the new technology for the small satellites and so on may be something for the future for them. But that was for me a very striking experience, because it's not an experience I had gone through, and I did not imagine how, you know, closing the distance nowadays was still a major challenge from some part of the developing world. So I found that quite a fascinating experience. A declaration has been adopted at the end of the conference, but I must say that there is still a lot to do for these countries in the Pacific. So that's really a story I wanted to share with you, because you had all the connection. You had the ICT, you had the technology. They have agricultural problems. They are confronting with climate change. They have transport infrastructure issues. So it's a Pandora box of challenges and a lot to do. And there are efforts, but I've left a little with mixed feelings, I would say.
You know, Anne, those are some great stories you've shared, and definitely shows the depth of your experience and the wide impact you also have during this discussion here. So I know that you have a demanding schedule, and we are indeed so fortunate to have somebody of your stature to take the time to do this interview, to share so much of your wisdom and experience with our audience. And thank you again for doing that.
Thank you very much, Stefan. It was also a pleasure to talk to you about all these issues, and I hope it will be helpful to your audience.
Well, it definitely will be, and so I would just want to close and say I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Anne Moreau, Director, Division on Technology and Trade Logistics, Head of the CSTD Secretariat, UNCTAD.